Here at Early Excellence, we specialise in early childhood education. We offer expert advice and guidance through training, consultancy and classroom design. With the Early Excellence podcast, we aim to inspire and support you as well as challenge your thinking. So if that's what you're looking for, you've come to the right place. Welcome along to our latest episode of the Early Excellence podcast. This week, we've picked out an episode to re-release that will really get you thinking about your practice and provision. So here you go. Here's my Early Excellence podcast chat with the wonderful Nikki Turner. Listen as we dig deep into the meaning of cultural capital in the EYFS. And I'm joined by Nikki Turner, who works for Astraea. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about Astraea and about your role at
Astraea? Yes, okay. Yes, so I work for Astraea Academy Trust. So we are a large MAT. There's schools mainly in South Yorkshire, so Sheffield, Rotherham, Doncaster. There's also schools in Cambridge, but they're secondary schools. So I'm working with the primary schools. There's 18 primary schools in South Yorkshire, and I'm working with them to help them to improve their EYFS practice. And the overall goal is to improve outcomes for children so they've got better life chances.
Fantastic. Really interesting role you have.
So, yes, and I've been teaching since, I started teaching in the last millennium. So I've been teaching for quite a while, 20 odd years, and I've learned a lot in that time. So it's really great that I can now support other teachers to develop their practice from everything that kind of I've learned over my period as early years teacher. And I've always taught in the early years.
Yes. I think it's something that I often say is that you couldn't do this sort of role. You know, like my role supporting teachers and practitioners, you can't do it unless you've got that body of experience behind you. You know, it really gives you that that confidence to be able to do it. But also, I think people trust what you're saying because you've got that experience.
I've done it in real life.
You've done it. You've made the mistakes. You've seen what it's like when it works, when it doesn't work, and everything else in between. And you can then hand on heart say, well, this is my advice because I know that it works.
Absolutely. And those things that I know, if I was in teaching, that would not work.
Yes.
Exactly. And I'm only going to advise people on things that I know that works in the classroom.
Yeah.
From a practical point of view.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it is hard being an EYFS teacher.
Gosh, it's hard,
You've got all of these, you know, children that come in with all of these different experiences at different levels, bringing all of these different, and their brains are, you know, very, very active. So,
challenging but rewarding.
Absolutely.
Without a doubt.
It's my favourite year group.
It is, yeah, all good. So, when we were talking about putting the podcast together, we had a call a couple of weeks ago, and I said, so we've got the date and the diary. What do you want to talk about? And you said to me, what I'd really like to talk about is cultural capital. Okay. And I was kind of a little bit surprised because I wasn't expecting you to say that. Because I'll tell you why, because in my mind, cultural capital has become associated with Ofsted and around a kind of almost like a kind of a particular phrase, and it feels to me a bit like it's become something that you do or something that you signpost as part of an inspection.
Okay,
so a little bit like that sort of British values kind of idea that you know that British values becomes a bit of a phrase for Ofsted, and what you end up with is schools trying to signpost inspectors to it by having a kind of a display up of kind of I don't know, red double decker buses and post boxes and British things, you see what I mean, in inverted commas. And so I was a little bit surprised. And then obviously once we started to chat about it, it made perfect sense in that actually we're talking about something much more than actually something that is kind of just a narrow thing that you might put together as almost like a box-ticking exercise. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So could we start off by by defining, from your point of view, what it is that you're meaning by cultural capital.
Yes, because it is.
So that it's not really
you were
kind of
thinking. Yeah. That was your perception of it. Yeah. My perception, what I did in my own practice, is very different.
Yes.
It comes through like the planning dynamics, really. So when I was planning, I followed the four themes: unique child, enabling environment, positive relationships, learning and development, and the cultural capital aspect for me is in that first layer, because we're having children and the families that they are from come into our school, and we need to know about them.
Yes.
We need to know what makes them tick. What are they all about? What experiences do they have? What is coming into my class? Because I need to know how to best support the child and the family. So for me, the cultural capital is basically about more the culture of the family.
Yeah.
The interests of the family. What makes that family unique? And really, I wanted to create a place of belonging. So every child feels that they belong in my class, that they can see aspects of them, aspects of their family represented in my environment. Because at the end of the day, we're there for an awfully long time.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Isn't it? It's like 5 days a week, from sort of like maybe 8:30 till 3:15. We're in that environment. So I wanted the children to feel like they belonged. So it's that sense of identity, actually. That's where I'm coming from.
Yes,
cultural capital.
Absolutely. And I think all of the things that you're explaining as part of what you would say is cultural capital are absolutely right. No, perhaps would certainly have gone along with exactly the same thing and did as part of my practice. I probably haven't really talked about it as cultural capital. Mm. No, I've talked about it as relationships or identity or belonging. You know, all of those things, all of those words that you've just been using.
So we're not necessarily.
Yeah, and I think I do think this is important, that actually cultural capital is something that is important. It is something that has, I think, a lot more depth to it, as you're explaining, than actually kind of just almost sort of doing a sort of surface level thing. It's about actually really knowing your children, knowing your families, having those relationships with them, in order that, first of all, well-being is high.
Yeah.
Because of course we know that, you know, young children, or anybody really, if you're not going to learn, you're not going to develop effectively unless you've got that high level of well-being, unless you feel secure, unless you feel that you belong in some way, unless you feel that the people in this group know you as an individual. These are things that are not just about early years practice. They're actually about being a human being, aren't they?
This is it. This is the thing about in education, that actually we're working with human beings, and we need to understand that human being and how they work and what makes them tick. And I wanted to build connections with these children and the families, because I felt that, you know, when you meet somebody and you instantly have that connection and then you develop that good relationship with them, that's how I wanted it to be for the children, that they felt like a connection, that we are connected together.
Yes.
Because I felt that if children have got that connection with me and other members of my team, their well-being is going to be higher.
Yes.
We're going to have better involvement levels.
Yeah.
So yes, it's about, through understanding the children, the families, developing a sense of belonging, that's, you know, the connection, the relationship, which I think is really, really important. And sometimes we can forget about that, and, you know, like the unique child element of planning dynamics, because we're focusing on learning and development.
Yeah.
But learning and development maybe is not going to be as good as it could be if you're not looking at the cultural capital, of the children that are coming into your class. Because they're coming in with a very wide range of experiences. From my own experience as a teacher, I've had children that have like grown up on farms, they can ride quad bikes and KTM scrambling bikes, and they're, you know, doing all like marvellous woodworking. And then there's other children where their only other experience of being in the home is going to home bargains.
Yes. Yeah.
So they've got very limited experiences. And we need to understand that.
Yeah. And there's a huge difference, isn't there?
Massive.
And, you know, that sort of that getting to know what their background is, what their experiences are or aren't, mm-hmm. provides us with an opportunity to think, well, actually, how do I build that into my practice? Mm-hmm. How do I take that interest, that fascination, and use it as a driver almost for what I want to teach them more of?
Yeah.
But also, if this child hasn't had those experiences, what experiences would I want them to have?
Yeah.
You know, what would I want every child to have had the experience of?
Yeah.
And as a starting point, you know, what have they missed, really?
Mm-hmm.
And that's quite idealistic, I know, but I think it's an important starting point to think, actually, what does a child need? Because they're not going to get this time again. This is a short window of time, isn't it?
You have one shot at the EYFS. You're only going to have this year once.
Mm.
So the teacher, we need to be really mindful of that. This is the only opportunity for this child. So as the teacher, I have to do my absolute best, pull out all of the stops to make sure that this year has impact and that the child lives it and feels each day.
Yes.
Because every day means something.
Mm.
And yes, it's not even a year, is it?
No, absolutely. It's not really. And so there are different things here, aren't there, within it, that when a child is fascinated by something that perhaps they see the adults around them at home
mm-hmm.
being engaged in a particular job or occupation, you know, that they might have somebody at home or somebody that is in their family who is a bricklayer, for example.
Yeah.
And then you've suddenly got this child who has been alongside somebody who is mm-hmm. building a wall or whatever it might be, or fixing a car or whatever it might mm-hmm. happen to be. And this child, because of that experience, knows more about that than the other children will.
Yes.
And I think it's important to know that, first of all, as an adult in the class, but also to be able to use that information to help that child feel like an expert in it.
Mm.
So for them to think, well, actually, I know a lot about this. I'm the class expert in this. I can tell other children about this.
Yeah.
And to remember when we're telling a story or to when we are doing whatever we happen to do and that subject area comes up, fixing cars or whatever it might be, we say, oh, Fred, you'll know about this, or whoever it might be, you tell everybody about what that's called, because you'll know about this. That's called the engine of the car, or that's whatever that might be.
And we were always looking for opportunities for that, where the child can actually become the teacher.
Yeah.
And the adult is the one that's learning.
Yes.
And I found very often with, because lots of children are actually interested in superheroes.
Yeah.
And it might be that you think, oh, they don't want to have superheroes in class because it involves kind of like fighting and all of this sort of stuff. So you kind of veer away from it. But actually, superheroes can be a really motivating factor for children. Lots of children really love them. So it's a really valuable kind of like resource to tap into.
Yeah.
And then it might be that you don't know about all of the new Marvel characters that are coming out, and the child then teaches you all about it and the powers that they've got and storylines, and they've got lots of information.
Yeah.
And then the child feels good, and it gives them that element of control.
Yes.
I think I wanted that as well from bringing in sort of like the using cultural capital, is giving some autonomy to children as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
That they have control over elements of, not everything, but certain things that are happening in provision.
Yeah, and that is a crucial skill, isn't it? That self-control, is a crucial skill, you know, whether mm-hmm. we're talking about sort of self-regulation skills mm-hmm. or independent skills, even those kind of independent thinking skills of thinking through, well, what am I going to do with my time now? Mm-hmm. You know, what's my idea and how am I going to do it? Those are all important things, aren't they? They're important skills and attributes as part of learning, really. Yeah. Okay, so we've got that idea of really what we mean by cultural capital mm. in and that why it's important also mm. in terms of why we really need to aim for it as part of our practice, definitely. Mm. What about then, say, if we go right to back to the very beginning, kind of before you know these children who are coming into the class,
yeah.
okay, whether that be in nursery or whether that be in reception, wherever that might be within the EYFS, really, if we're talking about children coming into the class and you think, right, I've really got to use children's interests, children's prior experiences, I'm going to use that cultural capital, we need to really think about how are we going to get to know that information, don't we, in order to be able to run with it.
Yeah.
So you've really got to be organised in advance as part of the transition processes in order to get to it, really, haven't you, I think?
Yeah.
So what sorts of things would you generally recommend? I know schools and settings do loads of different yeah, things so around different transition. Things. How would you find out the information?
So what I've done as a teacher, the most valuable thing that we did was the home visit.
Yes, yeah.
Because then parents can talk really openly about themselves. They like to show you things. Children like to show you things, their favourite toys, new toys, you know, the new dog, the new cat, and all of these different things that they have in their home. And you're just there in
yes.
it.
Yeah.
And you find out that, you know, oh, James is really interested in steam trains and his dad volunteers at the Great Central Railway
yeah.
and knows how to fix steam trains. So you instantly find out that information. So home visits were really, really valuable. Yes. And if you are able to do home visits, do them. If you're not currently doing home visits, talk to your SLT. Is this something that you could do? I know it takes time.
Yes.
You know, and there'll maybe have to be release time, but actually it is well worth it because you are building that relationship. Well, we did the home visits before the end of the school year. We, you know, the last few weeks of term. So we can gather information because we use it to choose who were going to be the key persons. We looked at how yeah. children connected to us when we're on the home
yeah.
visit.
So that's great.
And it's like, oh, yeah. actually, Mr. Rawlings, that child connected yes. better with you.
Yeah.
You're going to be their key person.
Yeah. Fantastic.
So really, really amazing.
Yes.
So if you can do them.
Home visits, I think are well worth doing.
Absolutely.
It's interesting in that I often meet people who do home visits and they always say the same things. They say, well, mm-hmm. it does take a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
It can be really tricky to free up time to be able to mm-hmm. do it. There is the logistics of trying to send out times to all of the parents and to hope that they're in and all of, you know, all of those sorts of things. And so it can be tricky. But even having said that, everybody I've ever spoken to about home visits says, even with all of that, they are definitely well worth doing.
Yeah.
Because people will say things like, even before you even get to that idea of, well, how much I know about those children through it, you get to the, even on a simple level, you remember your children's names better at the start
yes.
of the year because there's something to hook that mm. name onto. You've got, you know, you remember, well, that's Fred, he's got a dog at home, and you know the dog barked when we mm. came to home visit, or you know you remember this child, you know they went crazy about superheroes or whatever mm. it might be. You've got a bit more than just a name on the register
yes.
to really get to know that child
Absolutely.
Before they come to you. So you remember the children
you
more.
You do, and then when like on their first day, you can say, "Oh, Drew, I came to your house, and you know I met your new kitten. How's Sooty getting on?" And it just, you know, because it's that building of the relationship,
yeah.
isn't it? And that you've got that familiarity. too, and it's not so scary coming into like your new class.
No, absolutely.
That can be a scary experience for children.
If you get an idea of which children are the confident children and which children are the ones that actually might hide behind the sofa the whole time that you're there, or whatever it might be. I once I did a home visit once, because we used to do home visits. I remember once I did a home visit of a little boy called Kieran, and when I knocked on the door, we knocked on the door, and he came and answered the door, and he was grinning away, really happy, and his mum shouted from inside, you know, let them in. And just as we came in, he said, do you want to know a joke? I said, yeah, go on then. And he said, did you hear about the man with five legs? I said, no. He said, his trousers fit him like a glove.
It's a good one.
It's a good one, isn't it? So, and I thought, crikey, you know, that's pretty impressive, isn't it? For a child to, A, remember a joke anyway, because jokes are not easy, but also to have the confidence to tell somebody you don't really know.
Absolutely. You might not find that out on the stage.
You know, I'll remember you straight. I mean, this is years ago now.
Yes, and that you're learning something about the family then, about their sense of humour.
You've already built a bit of a relationship, even within a short visit.
Yes. What's good about home visits as well is it breaks down barriers between like parents and teachers.
Yes.
Because sometimes parents might not have had a great experience at school. And so they are feeling nervous, fearful, distrusting of like school and teachers. But if they can see us in their own home and, you know, we have nice chats about things and it's more of a kind of on the same level, and actually we're on their territory.
Yes, I often find
creates a different dynamic.
Parents will often open up more within their own home environment, so they'll say, "Oh, do you know what we've not been sure about this. You know, we're finding this quite difficult. He or she's our only child, and we're finding it quite difficult. The idea that actually they're going to be at school. I've been really enjoying having them at home. You know, it could be that. It could be all sorts of things. And they'll often say something, or they'll say something that's concerning them about school, or concerning the child more that they might not have said had they been within the classroom environment.
Yes, because other people are there. You know, we've got stay and play days. Other people are around, aren't they? And they might want to tell you something, but really it's not the right environment. So you never find out what they want to tell you.
Absolutely. You know, it can be busy. It can sometimes be too busy. So I certainly think that helps. I do think in order to get the most out of a visit like that, you've got to be prepared, like you say, I think, to meet them at a kind of on a level playing field. You can't go in there with a clipboard. Or an iPad or a kind of a list of key questions. Yes, or, you know, really, you've got to be quite
careful. Like a coffee warning, kind of low-key.
I think so. I think the more low-key you can make it, the more you tend to get out of it. Bizarrely, I know, because often usually the more you prepare and the more you kind of take along with things, usually you can get more out of it. But I think with a home visit, it's the opposite. Yeah. If you can keep it quite low key, you kind of leave space for the talk. Mm. Whereas if you go along and you've got a long list of questions and things I want to check, it tends to be a bit like I'm checking up on you, a visit to check.
Yes, and that can lose the confidence and with parents. There was one home visit I did where we went out into the back garden because the child wanted to show us their new trampoline, and it was one of those really massive ones. So Helen, my nursery nurse, and me and the child and their stepdad we're on the trampoline having a great time. But it's seeing the teacher as well in that more of like a playful
that appreciating that the relationship comes first, doesn't it?
I think that's and then you can find out about this cultural capital.
Yeah, you can.
Because it's more open.
You can.
Other ways, you know, because there are some schools where we couldn't do the home visits.
Yes.
So we used to send out, you know, kind of like an all about me.
Yeah.
But we'd, you know, like the normal sorts of questions. Obviously, we'd have like the normal sorts of questions about like name, date of birth. Have you got any siblings? Name of parent, you know, all about the grandparents, that sort of thing. But we'd also ask, have you got a favourite football team? Yeah, who do you support?
All sorts of things. It's interesting, isn't it? To try and
find out more things about the family.
It's just teasing out that conversation.
Yes. Because then if we know that, we've got some I'm from Leicester, so I'll say Leicester City supporters, that I will be talking to children about, Vardy, I saw him score a brilliant goal, that was an amazing penalty. I might not be interested in football, but if I know the child is interested in football, I can strike up conversation.
You can have some sort of connection.
And maybe the child is, shy or confident, doesn't want to speak, but if I'm speaking to the child about Vardy, then they, if that's their thing, sometimes. They come to lolly.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think is an interesting thing to consider as well, though, alongside this. I think that we've also got to be wary that not all children will have had the same experiences.
No.
So we've got to be careful that actually we don't create an environment, a learning environment or practice that favours the children who have had more experiences. Mm. Do you see what I mean? It's a very easy thing to fall into, isn't it? A trap to fall into. That actually what we end up with is the children who've had more experiences, then are more confident to talk about those experiences, and then they benefit more from an approach that is built around interests and experiences. Yeah. Whereas other children who come to school not having, they perhaps haven't got that to start off.
Particularly at the moment with, these children were in the lockdown.
Yes.
So looking at places where I was teaching during that period, I taught in a rural setting, so the children were out on farms.
Yeah.
Having amazing time. And then I was in the city.
Yeah.
And the children in the city are locked in flats.
Yeah.
With no access to the outdoors.
Completely different experience of lockdown.
Completely different experiences, and those children have developed differently because of those experiences. So you've got one child that's going to give you a lot, and another child where going to find it really difficult to find things out.
Yes.
So with children like that, we would set up interactions, but you have to be really thoughtful and really, really careful.
Yeah.
Because if you go in straight away, you might sort of like put the child off.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
So it's about being very, very sensitive. And these things have to be built up over time. You're not going to know this in like week one of being in school. You've got to build up these interactions and relationships slowly, and it might be to begin with, depending, like a child's very shy, they might have very limited communication and language skills, that you're observing them, seeing where they go and play in your environment. Are there certain things where they prefer to go and play? Going in and just parallel playing, if you're in the water, they're in the water, you're sort of like just copying what they're doing. And it's just a very kind of like slowly, slowly approach.
Yeah.
Maybe then you start to talk and add things in.
Yes.
And then you're looking out for a child that might look at you as, communication is not just speaking, is it?
No, of course.
So it's like eye contact, gestures, it might be like noises. Mm. So we'd be looking out for that, and basically to take our time in developing the relationship with the child and finding out about them. And I think, we're following children's interests.
Yes.
And putting that into provision, because that's what we did with the Cultural Capital.
Of course, yeah.
Like bringing, Jane likes trains, so let's make sure we've got a book about trains, and we've got the Flying Scotsman book and stuff like that. But I do think with some children who have limited experiences, that you might have a train set in your class and all they do is play with the train set because that's the only experience that they had.
Oh,
and they feel safe
there
because they know what to do, and then they're never venturing out into any of your other provision because what they know, what they're familiar with, where they feel safe is here. So then you've got to work with that child. It has to be done again really, really carefully of broadening their horizons.
Yeah.
And this is the bit where it's like the learning and development, that we need to give these children experiences, because maybe all of my class, they were in flats during lockdown, they haven't been anywhere. How do we know that they're going to be a really keen historian if they've never had access to anything to do with history? So then you need to be providing these experiences for them.
Yes.
Because we don't know what they're going to like. They don't maybe know.
Absolutely. And so that's that idea of, for the children who you think haven't had any of those experiences, we need to be bringing those experiences in to our practice in order that we can then build on it.
Yes.
And, do you know, and they could be simple, couldn't they?
Absolutely, they could be simple. But these children that maybe, you know, on the surface level, they think, oh, there's not much going on in that family. Mm. But it could be that they're going to the bingo every Friday night.
Yeah, yeah. You've got to connect in some way.
These are other things that are happening in the family that, you know, they're going down the football and they're going to the bingo and there's all of these, like, social events that actually...
Yeah.
That's really great stuff.
Absolutely.
We need to know about it.
Yeah, definitely.
But we'll find these things out over time.
Yes.
You're not going to know it all at once.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are certain, I think there are certain routines that you could, that you can put in place as an early years teacher that are about doing things together, almost like a family, you know, a family ideally would do, but that you're doing it kind of with a, within a class group.
Yeah.
And they're sort of the same belonging idea is involved around it. So, for example, you know, a walk to the park that might happen on a regular basis, not every week perhaps, but maybe every 2 or 3 weeks, that you go and you'll have a walk to the park and have a, see a different thing together. Or you might have a group of children who go with an adult to go and buy the snack on a Friday.
Yeah.
And that actually a walk to the local shops and back actually could be the sort of thing that, that some children just don't get the opportunity to do.
It
could be that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, so it doesn't necessarily need to be, you know, a great big grand gesture.
No,
just you know, a big trip to the seaside necessarily.
Yeah, it could be really simple
trip out, really.
Even on like your school grounds.
Yeah.
Going around the school grounds. Doing stuff, looking for things, going on adventure together.
Yeah.
Doesn't have to be, you don't need to be going to like Mablethorpe for the day.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
All of these, like, really amazing trips.
Yeah.
Use what you've got, but set it up more like a family that you're going to go and explore together and find out together.
Yes.
Then children become interested in it.
Yeah. I think also what you mentioned to me before was that idea of not just the children but the adults in the class, and how actually in order to build that ethos, I suppose, around cultural capital and value in the individuals within this class group, that actually that includes the adults as well. And I think that's such an important point.
We used to share a lot of our kind of like lives with the children, because if we're expecting them to share stuff with us and families to share stuff with us, we were quite open with them really about our interests. So, you know, that children all knew that I was really loved horses and I got these animals, and they knew that Mrs. Broughton was terrified of spiders. So occasionally they played tricks on her with spiders, and they know that Miss Cresswell does yoga. So they know about us and we're sharing the experiences and trying to find things that actually we've got in common.
Yes.
And I remember once there was one of our girls, her cat had died, and so we were having discussion as you know, like a group, and I said, oh, you know, your cat has gone to like the Rainbow Bridge. So we had discussions about where do animals go when they die, because it was a Church of England school. So, you know, we learn about like, you know, going to heaven and stuff. And so children were like, do animals go to heaven when they die? So we talked about the Rainbow Bridge. And then a couple of weeks later, my dog, I had to have Pippin put to sleep. And I was in school the next day and I was upset, and the children were like, oh, Miss Tanny, look a bit upset today. Whereas, oh, but I had to have Pippin put to sleep yesterday. And Beth, she's a dog lover. And so Bev and me were a bit sort of like tearful. And then the girl who had the cat that died said, Miss Tanny, don't worry, because Pippin's at the Rainbow Bridge. And then we were all just like crying. But it was that, you know, that shared experience that we have these animals and we love them, and then our animals have died, and then we're in this like grief, sharing the grief together. But that was actually really lovely.
But yeah, absolutely. I mean, and what it makes me think of as well is that learning is built on the strength of the relationships, but and also the language, you know, the conversation, the talk that's happening. And that actually you've got a really strong foundation for learning there. If you're building those relationships and you've got that closeness and you've got that understanding and that security within it, and then alongside that you've got the talk. So the children know that you love horses, for example, and so you can tell them a story about it. You'll never guess what happened this morning when I came went to see the horses. You will never guess. And what you're doing there is you're drawing them in because they know how much the horses mean to you.
Yeah,
you see what I mean? So in isolation, just say, "Oh, you'll never guess what happened to me." Might draw them in a bit, but it might not. Whereas when you've invested something emotional in that, because you've got that. They've built that relationship with you, you've absolutely got their attention.
Absolutely. And they'd say, "Miss Turner, tell us the story of when," you know, because they enjoyed it. And children would tell us their stories. And this is an important bit as well, Andy, about storytelling.
Yes.
That storytelling doesn't have to be from a book.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes children get put off storytelling because they think it has to be read or it has to be written down.
Yes.
Yeah. But if we can explore storytelling, like traditional kind of, storytelling.
In an actual way.
Telling a story. And children get confident. And Miss Turner's telling her story of horses, and Broughton's telling the story of like the ginormous spider that she had to phone up someone to come and get out of the house because she didn't dare touch it. The children love these stories.
And repeating stories is important, isn't it?
You know, it's not just again.
You know, we do that, don't we? We say, "Oh, you know, when we get together with friends that we maybe haven't seen for a while, what we do is we reminisce. Yeah. We tell that story again. Do you remember when?"
Yeah.
And it's what brings us together a bit, doesn't it? It brings us together as human beings.
Finding that connection.
And it helps us to connect, and it provides a rich context for learning as well.
Yes. Interesting. There's a boy that I taught the other year who'd got a motorbike, and then I showed him a video of me riding a motorbike. How does he ride that bike? Because I was going very, very slow. But it was great. We could have like discussions on it, and it was really valuable. Children feel valued.
Yeah.
But then within the provision, how it worked was that there's just snippets where children are represented. So there's a sense of belonging, not everywhere. And it wasn't that, children are, they're interested in Darth Vader, so all we're doing is Darth Vader all year.
Yeah.
But there'd be like an element of Darth Vader in the class.
Yes.
But it doesn't take over everything.
Yeah.
It's just there, but it's quite subtle.
Yes, they know it's there.
They know it's there,
but maybe not everybody has spotted it because they're not interested.
They're not interested in it.
Yeah, and that's a very good point because it's got to be meaningful, hasn't it? I think that where this sometimes breaks down is where people will say, "Well, I'm following the children's interests," and it might be a group of children who are interested in, I don't know, dinosaurs, say, and then suddenly all of the classroom provision has become dinosaur themed.
Yes, and you're doing a topic on dinosaurs.
And it's the whole lot. And it just becomes incredibly tenuous. The home corner somehow has ended up with a dinosaur theme. And you think, "Well, why?" You know,
and all of that kind of thing. No, it wasn't like that. It was just part of, like in continuous provision.
Yeah.
Or it might be that it becomes like an enhancement, but it doesn't take over everything.
Yeah.
It's very, very subtle. And it actually might just be conversational.
Yeah.
And something about what I think is valuable about cultural capital too is that in school, you've got to be wary that it's instructional.
Yes.
Everything is instructional with children,
yeah.
Whereas we want conversation. So actually using the cultural capital enables conversation about what we're doing in our own lives.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Where we're similar and where we're different. And, we've got, James is really into the Flying Scotsman, so I've got the Flying Scotsman book. Let's have a conversation about it. Tell me what you know.
Yeah.
And it's just within provision.
And, of course, at the moment, particularly, I mean, that's always been important, but at the moment, particularly at this point where you think, actually, so many children are coming into schools not having not having acquired those skills in terms of speech and language mm-hmm. and communication, and that we really need to get up and running with that. And there's that real focus on that.
Absolutely.
Actually, this approach is the perfect way of doing that, isn't it?
If they've got an interest and they can talk about it,
yes.
then they're more likely going to be able to write about it. So the other year when I was teaching at Swannington, mm-hmm. there was a boy called Charlie. And Charlie does not like writing at all. And he just wants to really be outside, mm-hmm. being physical. And he particularly liked construction. And then one day we were just talking about the new Star Wars movies. And he was talking about The Mandalorian. So I said to Bev after school, I said, right, let's get some Mandalorian stuff for our editor's box. Because we had this writing area. It's more than a writing area. It's a publishing area.
Okay.
So we put images with from the Mandalorian movie in there. And then in the morning, we said to Charlie, look what we've got for you. And Charlie spent hours in there.
Yeah.
Because we said, we don't know anything about the Mandalorian, Charlie. We haven't got a clue. Can you teach us about it? Write it down and we'll read it later. And then we were like, you know, Charlie, do you want to go out and play now? Do you want to go outside? He's like, no, I'm doing another piece about the Mandalorian.
Brilliant. Yeah. And that's very powerful, isn't it?
Yes. And we tapped into his interests.
Yeah.
And actually, he knew a lot. And when motivated, he'd got some really good literacy skills. This came from, I was lucky enough to have trained with Helen Bromley.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And this is going back into sort of like the second half of like the noughties. So quite a long time ago. And Helen shared an article called We Hear You, Joshua.
Yes.
And it was about a child who had poor literacy skills in class and really demotivated, low involvement, not making the progress, teachers worried about, you know, what he's doing. And it turns out that once they got to know Joshua and that in his family, they were all into superheroes. Joshua was particularly into superheroes. And at home, Joshua creates his own comic strips. And when they looked at the comic strips he was creating at home, they're really advanced compared to what he was doing in school. And it was because in school, they're doing like fairy stories and rewriting fairy stories. And he has no interest. So he had no motivation. Doesn't want to do it. Whereas actually, he was really able, but doesn't show his ability at school.
Wow.
But then it was like a project that they did. It was his TA that did this project with him. And then it's like, right, let's put things out that Joshua is interested in. And that's kind of like when I started this editor's box.
Yeah.
And then we'd have images. As soon as we know children are interested in something, it's in the editor's box. And we had like wallets of different things. So there was some girls where we just heard a conversation about Shimmer and Shine and Miss Cresswell, who's my nursery nurse, and we were like, what is Shimmer and Shine? We've got no clue. Children told us about it. It's like, right, let's get some Shimmer and Shine images.
What is Shimmer and Shine?
They're like superheroes. They're kind of like but you know, like the Powerpuff Girls?
Yeah.
Sorts of lines, like a cartoon. Yeah. Superheroes, female. So we put that out and you've got it. These girls are then writing Shimmer and Shine stories.
Yeah.
And then we've got the Mandalorian. They're writing Mandalorian stories.
Yeah.
And then use it. And then they knew that in phonics, which they didn't really like, you know. But then we talk about, in phonics, you're learning these skills and then you can use them to write about the Mandalorian. And then they started to get it.
Yeah, it gives them it's meaningful, isn't it? Then?
Yeah,
you think, well, actually, that's why I need to know that skill.
Yeah.
There's a reason for it. Mm. Whereas if that part of the day, and phonics is a good example, sometimes phonics is just done and then that's it.
Yeah.
But if we teach a skill children, in order to really know it and then embed it, need to know why they need to know it. They need to know that it's a meaningful skill. Mm-hmm. And I think this knowing, that idea of knowing what makes that child tick, means that actually you can say, well, because you'll need it for when you're doing your comic book, you'll need it for when you're doing this.
Yes.
Yeah, all of those sorts of things.
Yeah, and it makes it meaningful for the child and then motivated to do it then. And actually then become more motivated in the phonics because they see purpose.
Absolutely.
Rather than, oh, Miss Turner makes us do this lesson for like 20 minutes, half an hour, and they don't really like it because we want to go play in the construction area. But the cultural capital, it wasn't just brought in to like the writing, to motivate writing, but you know, we had a woodworking area and there's some children that, you know, on the farm, they're making really elaborate things, like their own insect homes and bird stands, and one child built a boat with his granddad. And it's like, right, okay, so my woodworking area, I have to be providing some advanced stuff now.
Absolutely.
For these children who actually are very, very able. Yeah. And if I'm just doing like knocking nails in, that's holding that child back. And they're not going to be showing their, you know, true kind of like ability. So it's not just for the writing. It was kind of like all
the areas. It's that depth, isn't it? It's that depth of thinking about all of those experiences, using what you know about the children and using what you know about the materials and resources that you're offering and linking the two together.
Yeah. And in a family where they were real into sports and being fit and healthy and strong, we set up like with a wheelbarrow and transporting like 6 tons of sand.
But it's meaningful.
But it's meaningful, and it's all about fit and strong, and that child then really connected to that. And then, you know, like you said, that child that then is the expert, and you can see the chest all puffed out because they are the one that's really strong that can load the sand into the trailer.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then, you know, wheel it up the hill because they are so strong. And it just makes them feel great about themselves. And then other children are like, wow, I want to be doing that too. I want to be strong.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
In terms of the... what this... Again, so that coming back to what it looks like in terms of practice, planning is going to be something that people ask about. Okay?
Yeah.
So, say if we're saying, right, we want to know all of those interests about those children, what makes them tick as a learner, what drives their learning, how would you record that in terms of planning? How would you go about doing that? Have you tried different ways?
With planning, I was like, we've got all of these things going on in our provision. How on earth is this recorded? And it's fine, you know, because you might not need to record but there are some settings, schools, where you have to have planning in, or people will ask to see your planning, and it's like, oh my goodness, I've got nowhere written down about the Flying Scotsman, or, you know, my woodworking. There was one child that was really into the Prodigy. You sound like the Friday rave and listen to like Chemical Brothers and the Prodigy and all of these things that this child knew about. And his mum and dad, they were, you know, like in the 90s, and it was really important for them, that music scene. And it came into our class. Where is that in my planning? Yeah. I hadn't got a clue how to record it.
Yeah.
But I asked Helen Bromley.
Good question.
This is what's happening in my classroom. How on earth do I record it? And she told me about the nature needs implications planning grid, that it's just the three columns, and it's really, really simple. So if you're the nature of the child is that they're, you know, really interested in Star Wars, or that they're really active and want to be physical, that's their nature. What is it that they need? And so, you know, the child that is interested in Star Wars or trains or Shimmer and Shine or whatever, they need an adult to show an interest in that. They need resources within the classroom to explore their interests further and become even more expert. That's what we were looking for as well. So get even more expert at Flying Scotsman. We have to, you know, resource our classroom, and it's about the adults as well. That's what they need. So what are the implications? Right, put the Flying Scotsman book in my book area. I'm putting this out in construction. I'm going to make sure I've got this in my edited box. So it's just seeding bits in the classroom. Yeah. The sort of like enhancements, but it's very, very subtle.
And presumably some of it might be about the adult. So you might say, it doesn't always make sense that it's a resource. It might be that we say, right, this adult is going to be alongside them.
Yeah.
Making sure they've got that language to go with the interests that they've got.
Absolutely, because the best resource in the class is your adult, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So it was more about like the adults as well. Go and we used to, in our kind of timetable, map in adults spending time with children, because there are certain children that are in like your radar, and then others that are on like the sidelines and they can get forgotten.
Yes.
So we made sure that on like the nature needs implications planning, that it's like every day adults need to go and spend like 10 minutes with this child, because their nature is actually could be language development, so they need this, so the implications are. So it wasn't just about like the cultural capital.
No, sure.
It was kind of like lots of things, really.
Yes.
But it's all of those subtleties that not on like your weekly planner, which is more kind of just continuous provision or project work, adult-led activities. In the EYFS, there's all of these different layers to the onion that's going on in your environment. So Helen sharing that with me was a massive help. It was, to begin with, it's a bit of, it is a bit of work. There's a lot of thought, and then you're writing it down. But actually, the natures of these children didn't really change. And if I look at myself, when I was four, I was obsessed with horses. As a 48-year-old, I am still obsessed with horses. So we've got these like things in us that we're really interested in. So once it was done, it wasn't that we were having to write it out all again, like weekly or half-termly or whatever. Sometimes we just add bits in. The more we knew about the child, we're starting to add things in, because this kind of like develops over the whole year.
Yes. And of course, what it leads to, because you're prepared to really connect with that child and then also extend their thinking or knowledge or skills around one area, using one area or one interest, that what you get to presumably is a real depth there. I'm trying not to use the word, the term greater depths, you know what I mean? That real depth of understanding of an area, of really being interested in it and going into real depth in it and learning skills around learning about it.
Yes, and then with the editor's box, which is like a publishing zone, they can then go and make their book, their non-fiction book, all about everything that they've learned about the Flying Scotsman, and they'll hopefully know more information that they from what they knew at the beginning of the year, because we've done like mini projects on it.
Yes.
Then, and these things, that's in the nature needs implications plan. It's like, why is there, why is that child learning about the Flying Scotsman? Why are they making a papier-mâché Flying Scotsman, engine? Oh, well, because James needs to explore this, and he's doing a topic on, this is his own project, and it's part of the provision.
Yeah.
I always remember when Harley turned up at school and he's like, founding in, he said, I'm going to make Thor's hammer today. Because his thing was superheroes. But within our provision, we'd got the atelier.
Yes.
So in the atelier, there was all the jaunt modelling. Children were taught how to use papier-mâché. So during the day, that's what he did. He came in with the idea of making Thor's hammer. We're allowing him to follow his interests, because we're using cultural capital. We know that is important for the child. Thor, and now he's going off to create, and he made this amazing hammer and papier-mâché'd it once it was dry, painted it up, and then he made a display and labelled it all up, and there was like a drape on the table, and then he'd got a block out of block play and positioned it, because we in our class, that's how we display stuff, so he kind of displayed it how we would display it. And that was it.
But isn't that fantastic that through that approach, he knows that he can have an idea and then come and do it and be successful with it. And by the end of the day, he can display his own work using a variety of different skills, including writing and a range of other sorts of physical skills too.
Yes.
And that's done through him driving it.
He's driving it. And at that, I remember the time of the year, because we did do, we've got continuous provision, but then we also like had projects and then projects within projects. Yeah. It's complicated. There's lots of layers.
Yeah.
And our project was, it was, we were having Venetian balls.
Yeah.
So we were making the masks, and it was Cinderella, and we were the staff at the palace, and we're going to set up the ball, and children were learning how to dance, and we were watching like episodes of Strictly and stuff. It was, you know, real good fun project. So that was going on, but within that, and learning all about dancing and costume and preparation of parties, we've also got Harley, who can go off and make Thor's hammer, and other children that are going off and doing this and that.
Fantastic, yeah.
Absolutely. Lots of layers, fantastic. Andy. It's kind of like, you know, where you're a swan gliding on the top, but underneath there's a lot going on.
Loads going on
around. Loads going on.
Yeah.
But what we were looking for was children with high well-being and high involvement. And if we can put things in that class that they can connect to, we're getting a higher involvement. We might not see the high involvement in the phonics lesson or the adult-led literacy, but we're seeing the high involvement writing about the Mandalorian in Editor's Box.
Ooh. Nikki, that's powerful, powerful stuff. Thank you so much for joining us. I know people listening, wherever they happen to be listening, will find that really interesting and really useful to listen to you. So yeah, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you ever so much. It's been great to speak to you.
And you too.
So there you go. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you found the episode useful. Now you can stay in touch with all things Early Excellence by joining our mailing list and also, of course, following us on all of the social media platforms as well. Okay, have a good week, everybody, and we will see you next time.